Chapter 25. Of the Russian weather station, of the evidence of Eunice's return decades later, nothing now remained. All traces had been erased by wind and time. All artifacts and trash long since absorbed and recycled by the Evolvarium's machines. But the location was known to within a handful of meters, and as Lady Disdain adjusted her engines to maintain a hovering posture, there could be no doubt that they were sitting over exactly the right patch of ground.
"If there was anything large and magnetic sitting right below the dust, we'd already know about it," Dorcas said. "I'm afraid it's not looking good right now. Same for gravitational anomalies. If there's something buried right under us, within a couple of meters of the surface, it must have the same density as the rock, to within the limits of our mass sensors."
She was standing at a pulpit-like console, arms spread either side of an angled display.
"There are a few more things to try, though, before we think about looking deeper."
"Ground-penetrating radar?" Gribella asked.
"Already down to a depth of 3 meters over a surface area of 50 by 50. We can expand the search grid, of course, but it'll take time."
Gribella had his arms folded across his chest. "What about seismic?"
"On the case, again, the data will take a little while to build up."
From the gondola's downward-looking windows, Sunday watched as the tentacles picked up loose-lying boulders, lofted them high into the air, and then flung them back down at the ground. Other tentacles spread out as far from the airship as was possible, brushed their tips against the surface to catch the vibrations transmitted through the underlying geography. The arrival times of the impulses would enable Dorcas to build up a seismographic profile of the local terrain, penetrating much deeper than was possible with radar. It was slow and haphazard, though. The airship obviously didn't come equipped with specialized seismic probes or the routines to crunch the data swiftly. And Sunday wondered what effect all that crashing and banging was having on the Evolvarium's native inhabitants. If they wanted to approach this search in a discreet manner, without drawing attention to their activities, this struck her as exactly the wrong way to go about it.
"Eunice, Eunice, Eunice," she said under her breath. "Why couldn't you make this simple for us?"
Now that the construct was denied her, she missed having it around. Eunice might be an illusion, a parlor trick that only looked and spoke like a thinking human being. But her eyes were not Sunday's eyes, and she had seen things Sunday never would. "This wasn't exactly how I was hoping things would pan out," Gribella said, his musty aroma announcing his arrival by her side a moment before he spoke. "But I think we can trust Dorcas." Sunday was effectively alone now. The other overfloaters were busy with their instruments and technical systems, while Jitendra dug into first-hand summaries of the Evolvarium's history.
"You think, or you know?" she asked.
"Nothing watertight where Dorcas is involved, kid."
His voice was a low, confiding rasp.
"We just have to take things as they come and be flexible. She can be slippery, that's a fact. But then so can we."
He shifted something around in his throat. Some loose, phlegmy package that obviously felt at home.
"My manner back there. When I first picked you up."
He trailed off, as if he needed some invitation to continue.
"Go on,"
Sunday obliged.
"This line of work, you get to meet all sorts. Rich kids especially. Thrill seekers. I knew there was money behind you, but you're not really here for the thrills, are you?"
"I had a good life on the moon. I didn't want any of this. It came after me, not the other way round."
Sunday fell silent for a moment.
"You wouldn't be apologizing, would you, Gribilla?"
"For giving you a hard time?"
He shrugged, as if that was all that needed to be said on the subject.
"From here on, though, whatever happens, when I take a job on, I don't let my clients down."
"And if our host has other ideas?"
"We'll play things by ear. And if things get intense, you and the beanpole do exactly what I tell you, all right? No second guessing, old Gribella. Because if the shit comes down, there won't be time for a nice chinwag about our options."
"We'll listen," Sunday said. "Not as if we're spoilt for choice with guides out here.
Softly she added, "Thank you, Gribella." He made to turn away. She thought he was done with her. But something compelled him to halt. After a silence, he said,
"You asked about the marks on my skull, back when we were driving. Dorcas mentioned my run-in with the apostate. I figured you'd be even more curious after that."
"The way I see it, it's none of my business."
"Way I see it too. But not everyone would agree."
Gribelin looked down before continuing.
"I went a little mad out there. They put ideas in my head.
Little dancing men, figures scratched in rock. The apostate had gone mad himself once, but I think he got better. Took me longer. And maybe some of it's still lodged inside me. But that's between me and the God I don't believe in." The shadows had lengthened, and evening winds had begun to howl in from the northern lowlands when Dorcas lifted her gaze from a hooded viewer. "I don't know quite what to make of this," she said, fingering the fine adjustment controls set into the viewer's side. "Not sure how to break it to me that there's nothing here?" Sunday asked. "No." Dorcas pushed her hair back over one ear to hook it out of her eyes. "How to break it to you that we've found something? There's an object down there. It's metal, and it's not too far from the surface. Which, frankly, isn't possible. But the digging would have to wait until daybreak. It got cold at night, and cold made everything harder, but that was not the reason for their delay. At night, as the cold and darkness clamped down, the bottom feeding casts became much less active, generally opting to conserve energy and cool their external shells as close to the ambient surroundings as possible, so that they were harder to detect. The predators, conversely, became more active. Kills remained difficult, but the likelihood of success, once a pursuit or strike had been initiated, was now much higher. "There was never a good time to be down on the surface," Dorcas explained. "But night was worse than day, even for overfloaters, and they would not risk drilling until sunrise." "And the golem? We've gained this lead on it. What's the point in throwing it all away now?"
"Your golem is on land," Dorcas said. "That means it won't be going anywhere until sunup either. Not if it knows the first thing about the Evolvarium and wants to make it through to dawn in one piece. So get some sleep. Be our guests."
But Sunday couldn't sleep much, not while that thing was down in the rock, calling to her. So that night, while the overfloater held station and a skeleton crew manned the graveyard shift, she stood in darkness aboard the gondola and watched. Radar and infrared sensors swept the parched, dust-tormented plateau. Very occasionally, halfway to the horizon or further, something would break cover. Fleeting and swift, it would slink across the land's contours. The ambush predators were experts at concealment, from jack-in-the-box variants that dug themselves into rock holes and natural fissures, compressed like springs, to shape-shifting forms that were able to pancake their bodies into the very top layer of the dust to lurk unseen. There were things like flatfish and things like snakes. There were also stalking, prowling horrors that quartered the night on endless deterrent patrols, searching for the weak, the maimed, or the dead. She saw one of these loping, jackal-like things traverse the horizon line. It had so many jointed legs that it appeared to move in spite of itself, riding a bickering tumble of independent limbs. There was also something like a convoy of scorpions, one after another, that might, horrifyingly, have been a single entity, and a flat-topped creature like a house-sized hairbrush, supported on countless bristling centipede legs, that could have been a grazer or a killer. It was wonderful in a way, she supposed. There was astonishing variation in the Evolvarium, a staggering panoply of evolutionary strategies, body plans, survival mechanisms. Life on Earth had taken 3.5 billion years to achieve the radiative diversity that these swift, endlessly mutable machines had produced in a matter of decades. Artificially imposed selection pressures had turned life's clock into a screaming flywheel. The arms race of survival,
had been harnessed for the purposes of product development, feeding an endless supply of new technologies, new materials and concepts into the system-wide marketplace. In that sense, it was almost miraculous, something for nothing, over and over again. But it wasn't free, was it? The Evolvarium was death and fear, terror and hunger, on endless repeat. The machines might not have enough cognitive potential to trouble the gearheads, but that didn't make them mindless, no matter what Jitendra might care to think. She thought of the sifter Gribelin had told them about, the machine that had begged. Maybe he'd been exaggerating. Maybe he'd been imposing human values on an exchange that was fundamentally alien, beyond a gulf of conceptualization that could never be crossed. She wondered. She wondered and knew that she would be very, very glad when they were out of this place. Jitendra slipped his arm around her waist.
"I'm sorry about Memphis," he said quietly. "I'm sorry that we aren't back home with your brother, but I wouldn't have wanted to miss this for the world."
"Really?"
"It's marvelous," he said.
Beyond the horizon, the red and green radiance underlit the night's dust clouds. Something was dying in fire and light. Sunday shivered.